This is really a great pleasure for me. These are the kinds of events that I always look forward to when you get to honor the quality of our faculty. We are very fortunate, first of all, it's a great program, by the way. Very fortunate in the back, you'll note all of the previous award winners. We're very fortunate to have a number of them here. And if they wouldn't mind standing so that we could recognize them. Thank you all for coming. We really appreciate it. Let me introduce our speaker today. And again, a lot more detail is provided in the program. Dr. Shalhav is the Robert Ann and Burnett Professor of Electrical and Computer Engineering. He's also a faculty member in biomedical engineering. He received his master's degree in 1979 and his Ph.D. degree in physics and math in 83 from the Siberian Federal University in Russia. He then went on to have a Humboldt Foundation Fellow at Heidelberg and Paris-Sou. He also continued to teach and do research there as well as at the University of Toronto. In 93, he moved to New Mexico State as the George W. Gardier Professor of Physics, and then he joined Purdue in 2001. He was honored last spring as the 2009 Herbert Newby McCoy Award recipient. And there's a lot more detail in here, which I encourage you to read, but let me just briefly tell you that the McCoy Award is the highest honor that Purdue gives for research. It was established in 1964 by Mrs. Ethel Terry McCoy to honor her husband, who, if you read this, was also an academic as well as an entrepreneur. And she created this award to recognize a student or faculty member at Purdue making the greatest research contribution of the year. Nominations for the McCoy are submitted by peers, and recommendations are obtained, and the committee is appointed by the president. Dr. Shalhav received this year's award for seminal contributions both in the theoretical framework and experimental realization of optical metamaterials with strong magnetic resonance and negative refractive indices. And now we're going to get to enjoy his lecture entitled Transforming Light with Metamaterials, a New Paradigm for the Science of Light. Vlad.
Off to you. Thank you, Richard. Well, thanks for coming. First thing first, and let me to express my gratitude to my nominators, Professor Tim Sands and Andy Weiner, for doing this strange thing. And the committee, indeed, Vice President and President, for supporting this idea and giving eventually this award to me. It's indeed a great honor, and I feel very privileged and humbled standing on this stage and reporting our results. But most importantly, as well, the French say, behind success of any man, cherchez les femmes, look for a lady. Well, when you apply it for science, I guess, look for a team. So and it's my greatest privilege to have a team of wonderful people working this, made all this possible. And I'm really grateful to them, which includes my colleagues, Evgeny Narimanov and Alexandra Baltasova, my close associates, Dr. Alex Kildyshev and Dr. Vlad Drachev, and indeed my students. They are truly excellent. They are like my second family, extended family, whatever you call. I cannot imagine my life without my wonderful students who make this research so exciting. And what I would like to share with you today is the excitement we have from this research, because I would say this is a luxury when you have this opportunity to revise the very fundamentals of some particular field of science. And I keep repeating my students that what you guys are doing now, you are broadening the very basics of optics, which was formulated by Sir Isaac Newton in the 17th century, but creating things like a negative refractive index or bringing it to zero values, indeed touches the very basics of this very important science, the science of light. And of course, it touches many other things. For example, with a new family of devices becomes possible with this exciting metamaterial such as a superlens. And with a superlens, for example, you could break the fundamental diffraction limit, which was formulated by Abbey in the 19th century. So that's really a luxury and a rare opportunity, I should say. I've been doing research quite for a while already when you could play with very fundamental things. And some of them really go beyond at least my imagination. If someone 5 years ago would tell me that I would be working on clocking, I said, why are you making a joke out of this? I mean, I thought it's sci-fi. Now we are looking at this very seriously because it looks like scientifically, at least, it's all this possible. I have to define what I mean and others working in this field by this term metamaterials. Of course, meta in Greek means beyond. Just recall Metaphysics, a famous book by Sir Isaac Newton. In this, when we say metamaterials, we imply artificial design and artificial materials which are engineered and which have properties unattainable with those with materials in nature. So we want to go beyond what Mother Nature offers us with materials around us. Of course, we do have a large variety of atoms in the periodical table of them, and they have a very rich physics, very wonderful properties. But it turns out that there are some deficiencies. When light interacts with atoms in conventional media, when we speak of the optical range, out of the two field components, electrical field component and magnetic one, light actually probes atoms only with one of these field components effectively, with the electrical field component. Whereas the other one largely remains unused, I should say. So you could say that out of two hands, only one is really used for some fundamental reasons. But it turns out that actually could be changed by creating special artificial materials. And here you could see an example of such materials which we developed in our lab, consisting of just a pair of metallic rods, gold rods in this case. And it turns out this structure can be equally strong coupled to both field components, electrical and magnetic ones. That's indeed enriches physics and enables a number of interesting applications. Well, I also should define these materials in terms of their sizes, or better to say, the size of the structural units out of which these materials are built. With conventional optics, we typically deal with sizes which are much larger than the wavelengths, if you look at mirror or lens. And quite often, you could describe it with simple geometrical optics, or sometimes you use physical optics, but the sizes are macroscopic. There is a very important class of interesting materials, which is called photonic crystal materials. And the beauty of these materials is based on the fact that the structural unit actually matches the wavelengths. They act like a three-dimensional diffraction grating and provides very interesting properties. But there are examples, actually, of such structures in nature, such as a wing of a butterfly. All these beautiful colors actually occur due to the fact that it has the very nice periodical structure with the latest period matching the wavelengths. When it comes down to metamaterials, the size of the structural units typically is much smaller than the wavelengths. And in this case, you could use this very important notion of dielectric permittivity epsilon, which describes the strengths of coupling to the electrical field component, and magnetic permeability mu, which characterizes how strongly magnetic field component couples to these artificial atoms, which we call meta atoms. Well, a very important question one could ask, do these metamaterials which are artificial have to be periodic? Photonic crystals indeed have to be, but metamaterials actually not. And as often happens in science, many things which look very new, quite often unknown for decades or sometimes for centuries. And in that terms, materials such as these beautiful vases, in this case it's a Lucrecius cup, which has these beautiful colors, different whether you look at in transmission or reflectance, you could call that, you actually could call it as metamaterial, because what happens in this case, small metallic nanoparticles such as gold or silver are incorporated inside of glass, And because of that, you have all these beautiful colors. So you create new properties by using these metallic components. And this type of materials quite often now are called plasmonic materials because they support oscillations of free electrons, which are called plasmons. Or what is synonymous to these electrical metamaterials, because in this case, we control the coupling to the electrical field component. But the thing I would like to emphasize, even the ancients of that ages didn't of course use these beautiful fancy words, plasmonics, nanophotonics. Actually, these structures do represent a good example of such metamaterials or electrical metamaterials in this particular case. I also could not resist this temptation to show these fractal clusters, which was my kind of first love in science. They're actually very interesting structures because they are statistically scale invariant, and because of that, the localized electromagnetic radiation light in extremely small hotspots, nanoscale actually, areas where electromagnetic energy is concentrated and builds up to very large magnitudes, which enables a number of interesting applications, such as sensing, for example, surface-enhanced Raman scattering. And this is also an example of electrical metamaterials because we kind of artificially build it and create new properties. Well, let me start with this, what I call electrical metamaterials. When I say this, I emphasize that now we are focused on how to control decoupling of these metamaterials to the electrical field component. This field also quite often called plasmonics. It's kind of a fancy word because, as I said, emphasizes the fact that there are these plasmon oscillations or electrical metamaterials. And why it's important? Because arguably, one could say that one of the biggest societal needs nowadays is to improve the speed, or let's say to increase the speed with which we can process information. Everything about us is basically how fast we process information. All electronics, computers, it's basically about how fast we could deal with the information. And in that sense, I think this plot is kind of quite well reflects the situation. If you look at the past, how we did it in the, let's say, decades ago, of course, all devices were large, I mean, lamps or whatever, and they were slow. With electronics and nano-electronics, we have tremendous progress, and we could scale down the size of these structural nano-electronic elements down to a few nanometers only, a size of nowadays transistors just a couple nanometers or so. So, and that's of course huge progress because now you could place a huge amount of elements, electronic elements, on a single chip, and that provides you more efficient functionality. But the problem is, though, that the maximum speed which you could accomplish with electronics is still limited due to some fundamental RC delays. It could go probably up to 100 gigahertz, but that's about it. So you're hitting the wall. You cannot make it faster. With photonics, in contrast to that, actually, the speed with which you can process information is limited only by the Kerian frequency, which is 10 to the 15th. In other case, four orders of magnitude higher. However, with photonics, the challenge is to bring light down to nanoscale because the wavelength of visible light is half a micron, and it's extremely hard to couple a wave which has that large wavelength down to, let's say, 5 nanometer structure. As opposed to electronics, where it's easy to do, electrons have charges, you can really manipulate them on nanoscale. It's extremely hard to manipulate photons on nanoscale. And plasmonics, or let's say metal optics, or nanostructured metal, it's exactly the way, as many people believe, to combine, to bridge the advantages of both, to have the speeds of photonics and the size of nanoelectronics. Therefore, it seems to be so important. And these electrical metamaterials could be thought of structures which enable nanophotonics, processing of information with larger speed, using photons as opposed to electrons, and manipulate them on nanoscale. Of course, it's still a distant future. There are a number of challenges to overcome here, but the progress is also very impressive. And when you think of how you can really bring light to nanoscale, so you start developing these small optical elements which act in a similar way as the famous electronic elements, because metal has negative dielectric permittivity. It acts as inductance. And if you take a small nanostructured dielectric, which has positive dielectric permittivity, it acts as a capacitance. Actually, you could develop the whole LC circuitry and mimic all electronic elements. But the important difference would be that you would manipulate and control photons on nanoscale as opposed to electrons. And because of that, you could do it faster. With photons, we package information into a signal of zero mass and propagate it at the ultimate speed. So nothing can be faster with photonics. The challenge is how to manipulate and control photons on nanoscale. Here you could see some nano antennas which we are developing and building in our lab. These particular ones were fabricated by my colleague, Professor Baltasova. And you could see that the concentration of electromagnetic energy could be extremely high. The gap between these metallic structures could be as small as 5 nanometers, and the energy which builds up there could be 5 or 4 orders of magnitude larger than the energy in incident light. So that's the way to scale, to focus light down to nanoscale. But if you really start thinking of building all these essential elements for nanophotonic circuitry, of course, a critical thing is to have a source of photons on nanoscale. And in that sense, we are very proud to, we actually reported only a couple weeks ago that world's smallest nanolaser, and this work was done in collaboration with Norfolk State University and Cornell. And the idea here is as follows: for laser, what you need is a gate, amplifying medium, and you need a feedback system. And normally you do feedback system by having optical resonator. But the smallest size of optical resonator is half of the wavelengths. And as I mentioned, the wavelengths of light is roughly half a micron, so it's still quite large. So in the trick which we used, we would convert light into this plasmon excitations. And plasmon excitations are actually very interesting. They have the frequency of light, but the wavelengths X-ray radiation. So they could, the wavelengths of plasmonic excitation could be 100 times smaller than the wavelengths of conventional light. So by converting photons into these surface plasmon excitations, we shrink the size of the feedback down to, in this particular case, 22 nanometers only. And that's enabled us to have world's smallest nanolaser. And so what the structure looked like, it's what there was a gold core, 14 nanometers in size, which was coated by silica, which contained dye molecules. And dye molecules provide the amplification, which is also needed for lasing. It's kind of also interesting that this world's smallest nanolaser, we reported it at the time when the whole community is preparing to celebrate the 50th anniversary since laser was discovered. And to prove that we indeed have lasing, we did this critical experiments, which always prove actually that you have lasing. So what people do, they measure emission as a function of the pump. And you could see that when you increase the pump, the width of the spectral width of this emission line becomes more and more narrow. And that means that amplified spontaneous emission becomes large, and eventually stimulated emission takes over the spontaneous emission, and that's the feature of lasing. Another thing, you have this very nonlinear threshold-like dependence of output of generated light as a function of pumping. And both these key features, which people usually look for when they want to prove that they have lasing, of course, we obtain in our experiment. And that was very collaborative work, actually, involving quite significant number of players from all these three schools. This, for example, calculation done by my colleague Evgeny Narimanov. Well, now I'm switching to magnetic materials. So far, what I discussed, how we could control coupling to the electrical field component. And I emphasize the importance of this type of research for nanophotonics, eventually to speed up the rate with which we can process information. When it comes down to magnetic materials, we are trying to create materials which would have magnetic response. And we, in this case, we want to control coupling to the magnetic field component. It turns out that when it comes down to the materials in nature, all this magnetics which we are aware of, like ferromagnetics, paramagnetics, they actually work only at low frequencies. at high frequencies, at, for the optical range, magnetism is actually absent or almost absent. It's negligible. And that's actually expressed in this famous quote from what we call, at least theorists from Russia call it, the Bible of theoretical physics, a book written by Leo Landau, arguably one of the most talented physicists ever living. And he would basically write that for all materials in nature, when you go to high frequencies, magnetic permeability could be set equal to 1. And that's indeed true. For all materials in nature, mu is really very close to 1. And there is a reason for that. That's actually the magnetic response is by alpha squared smaller than the electrical response. That's what I meant when I said that the coupling to the electrical field component of conventional atoms is much stronger than the coupling to the magnetic field component, so that the light is, in a certain sense, is like one-handed. Well, what could we do to change this? It turns out, actually, you could use a very simple idea. It's basically textbook-like idea. You just have to create artificial atoms, meta atoms, which would emphasize the strengths of coupling to the magnetic field component. So to do this, one of the ways is, for example, to take pairs of metallic rods, silver or gold, and those two materials are considered to be the best in terms of their performance because they have the smallest losses at high frequencies, and which are separated by dielectric. When you radiate such a structure with light normally to the pair, then the magnetic field in this case penetrates through the pair of rods, and it oscillates in time. Since it varies in time, the magnetic flux going through this pair also varies in time. And according to the Faraday's law, there should be electromotive force and a current induced by this magnetic field. The important difference, though, here, that we actually create this current at extremely high frequencies, at the optical frequencies. One could argue, okay, you have these metallic rods here where you have this conduction current, but how about the dielectric? We take here the full advantage that at high frequencies, the displacement current, which is this dd over dt term in the Maxwell's equations, increases. The larger the frequency, the larger the displacement current, so that the conduction current in these metallic rods is closed by the displacement current. And that gives me LC circuit operating at optical frequencies. With metal, which has negative epsilon, as I mentioned, acting as inductance, and dielectric with positive epsilon acting as a capacitance, but at optical frequencies. And I control the frequency at which this circuit resonates by changing the shape or the size of the structure. This is like elementary LC circuit for optical frequency. And of course, I could take instead a series of these pairs of rods or just a pair of plates, pair of strips, and that would just simply enhance the magnetic response. And that's what we did, what we fabricated in our lab. We took two silver strips separated by dielectric, alumina in this case, and you could see here the AFM and scanning electron microscope pictures of this structure which we fabricated. And well, in this business, since everything is time-consuming and costly, we first always do simulations. And simulations is a big, big part of all our efforts. And that effort is led by Alex Kildyshev in my group, who is arguably one of the world's best person in terms of modeling these plasmonic structures. So what I'm showing here is the side view. You could see that would be the bottom strip. This would be the upper strip. And with arrows, I'm showing the displacement current. The color gives you the magnetic field component. For the incident light, it's 1. It's set to be 1. And you could see that between the strips, it's negative. The magnetic field looks against the magnetic field in incident light, clearly indicating strong magnetic response. And that is due to this loop current, which I was talking about. So if you want to look how it is going on in the course of time, of course, the magnetic field flips up and down, but the field between the strips always looks against the magnetic field in incident light. I mean, nothing would be surprising if not the fact that all this is going on at optical frequencies. And as I said, for our materials in nature, all these responses are extremely small, and when you sum it up, mu is very close to 1. So basically same as in vacuum. And this picture we're kind of particularly proud of. What we did here on this same glass substrate, we made a family of six different pairs of strips, magnetic resonators, with different sizes varying between 90 to 170 nanometers. And when you irradiate it with white light, those spectral components which these magnetic structures resonate, those components would be absorbed, and that results in colors. And you could see all the strong resonances in transmission and in reflectance, which result in this beautiful rainbow colors-like. But the thing to appreciate here again, all the colors we see in nature are due to the electrical field component. Here you see the colors which are magnetic in nature. So it's, if you wish, visualization of magnetism, artificial magnetism at optical frequencies. So in this plot, it kind of summarizes our effort, because what we did here, we are showing that by changing the widths of these magnetic strips, you could actually have resonance at any wavelengths in the visible part of the spectrum, from 470, which is blue part of the spectrum, to 750, which is the red part of the spectrum. And magnetic permeability, which is the gain for all materials in nature, is extremely close to one. With accuracy 0.01%, it's close to one. Here, it varies from 0.5 down to minus 1.7. So we created this artificial magnetism in the visible part of spectrum, which is not small, but very, very significant one. Why it's important? Of course, it's interesting by itself. I mean, when you increase the resonant frequency by four orders of magnitude in comparison to what Mother Nature offered to us before, it's, of course, quite interesting and makes us think of very interesting physics associated with this. And one of that probably, or perhaps even most exciting, has to do with this negative refractive index. Of course, refractive index is a very fundamental characteristic. It gives us the ratio by which speed of light, or to be precise, the phase velocity of light becomes smaller when light enters a material as compared to vacuum. It's a very fundamental, probably the most fundamental characteristic related to light. And as I often tell my students, lots of things look to us very revolutionary, and I guess we Russians must have special feeling toward this world revolution. And but in reality, it turns out that quite often we're standing on, as we say, in shoulders of some scientific giants who actually thought of very similar idea long, long ago. And that happened to me already a number of times when I would find out that things which we have formulated way before, but perhaps was not appreciated sufficiently by peers because it was so much ahead of time. When it comes down to negative refractive index, I was astonished to see a book written by Sir Arthur Schuster, who was actually German by origin and who spent most of his research career at the University of Manchester in the UK, where he was eventually knighted. And this is a quotation from his book written in 1904. Which clearly indicates that he did understand at that time the notion of negative refractive index. And again, I like to tell the story to my students that nowadays, just to get all this, I mean, we live in a very competitive world. We're always going for funding which enables us to do all this exciting research. But sometimes we perhaps going too far and always emphasizing how it's important, using all these fancy words, beautiful terms. This gentleman who wrote this book where he clearly described the notion of negative refractive index in 1904, he would not call his book as, let's say, modern optics or breakthrough in optics, whatever. He would call it Introduction to Optics. Very good example of modesty. Mandelstam, yes, yet another person who is a big scientific hero back in the former Soviet Union. In his lectures in the 40s at Moscow State University, he taught about negative refractive index. He also clearly realized that this notion does not contradict Maxwell's equations, and although nobody could really see these type of materials, but they realized that it's possible. If something doesn't contradict Maxwell's equation, it should exist, or at least could be created. And these two gentlemen, Professor Vissi Laga and Sir John Pendry, actually made this field so popular nowadays. They actually, I could say, protagonists for the fields. And we actually collaborate with Professor Visilaga. He visited us already 3 or 4 times, I don't remember, and he is coming again. And in November, Sir John Pendry will be also visiting us. They should be particularly credited for launching this new field of metamaterials. Well, and I mentioned that the notion of refractive index is indeed a very fundamental one. For example, it describes how light is refracted and reflected, well, refracted to be precise, at the interface between two materials with different refractive indices. In this case, well, which is the normal case, when we have two materials with positive refractive indices, let's say water and air, what happens, light would be refracted so that the angle with respect to the metal would be slightly changed. Well, maybe not that slightly. And we think also that the phase propagates against the flow of energy, because remember, the refractive index defines the phase velocity. If refractive index would become negative, then according to the Snell's law, the beam should go not this side of the normal, but this side. This is it indeed, but perhaps more important thing, which I'd like to draw your attention to, that the phase starts propagating against the flow of energy. It's extremely counterintuitive. Let's say you could think of this like you throw a stone in water and ripples, instead of going outward, would go inward. And it turns out that is a very important fact. That enables very unusual physics, the fact that the phase counterpropagates what we call the Poynting vector, characterizing the flux of energy. Another thing I'd like to draw your attention to, because I was speaking of this artificial magnetism, it turns out that if you want to formulate mathematically what is a necessary condition for refractive index to be negative, it can be boiled down to this simple inequality, where the prime index stands for the real part. And you could see, if you consider conventional materials in nature, where for the optical range mu is simply equal to 1, then this inequality becomes epsilon prime plus modulus epsilon smaller than 0, which is not possible because the magnitude is always larger than the real part only. In other words, to have negative refractive index, you have to create artificial magnetism. So it is important. When you create artificial magnetism, you can have materials with a negative refractive index. And of course, many interesting things would occur if, let's say, water would have, for example, negative refractive index instead of positive one. And maybe one day we would fabricate that bulky material with negative refractive index, and we could demonstrate all this. Our metamaterials are still quite tiny, small in size. So you see that normally it looks like this, but if refractive index would be negative, you would see this type of refraction. Well, yet another, perhaps even more interesting illustration of negative refractive index is like when you look at something underwater, like a fish in this case, it appears to be closer to the surface than it is in reality. If water again would have negative refractive index, fish would be floating. Right? The image of fish would be floating above the surface. It's quite unusual. I mean, I it's probably a separate thing, like if you start trying to imagine a world which would be built materials with negative refractive index. And this table actually sums up the tremendous effort in bringing negative refractive index to the optical range. Of course, all this about fabrication. And most of interesting and highly unusual counterintuitive phenomena associated with negative refractive index have been first demonstrated for the microwave range, simply because it's much easier to build those structures. And so since we kind of like challenges, must be related to my background, we focused on the optical range. And that was really, really a big effort. And we were lucky to actually first demonstrate negative refractive index in the optical range. And it was simultaneously and independently done with another group from University of New Mexico in collaboration with Columbia. So we demonstrated negative refractive index at 1.5 microns. They did it for 2 microns. And 1.5 is, of course, the telecommunication wavelengths, which is very important. And most recently, mainly due to effort of my excellent student, Shumin Shawa, I hope she is somewhere here in the audience, we brought this negative refractive index to the yellow light, which is 580 nanometers. And the way we did it, we used this, exactly these magnetic strips, which enable artificial magnetism due to the reason I described above. And we combine them with what we call electrical strips. It's also metallic strips, but perpendicularly oriented with respect to the magnetic strips, so that you have something like fishnet. This structure we call it fishnet. So it's silver, dielectric silver layer, and it looks like a fishnet. That's our material. And when we did measurements and all the retrieval procedure, so we clearly could claim that we have now that small but negative refractive index at 580 nanometers, which is yellow part of the spectrum. Well, one of the perhaps most exciting application related to metamaterials, but certainly not the only one, it's what people call superlens and hyperlens, because that breaks the diffraction limit and allows seeing things much smaller than the wavelengths. Simultaneously, not point by point, but simultaneously the whole thing, which makes it different, for example, from the famous near-field optical microscopy. What it has to do with, when you look at how actually the image is formed, so as follows from the Maxwell's equation, the wave vector which describes how electromagnetic wave propagates and how actually you translate information in space is given by this expression, where k naught is simply omega over c, frequency over the light of speed. And those are transverse components of the wave vector. If you have small features in your object, much smaller than the wavelengths, the corresponding wave vectors which bear information about that fine features would be larger than the wavelengths, meaning that this thing count, the square root, would become negative. And because of that, all those components are evanescent. In other words, with conventional optics, you cannot bear information about small details which are smaller than the wavelength. That's the diffraction limit formulated by Arbe, very fundamental thing. It turns out if you take a lens with refractive index equal minus one, then those evanescent components which were responsible for this information about fine details, let's say 100 nanometer in size, which normally you would not be able to see, would get amplified. And it's not because there is some kind of laser there, or just simply because you excite this surface plasmon resonance. In the course of time, you accumulate light energy, and that energy is converted into this evanescent component. So that in principle, you could completely restore that information. And the this type of lens actually was first considered by Professor Wisselager in his seminal 1968 paper published in the Russian journal Uspekhi. It's the probably most prestigious journal in the former Soviet Union. He would say that if you have a slab with negative refractive index, which same in magnitude but opposite in size to that of the surrounding medium, then no matter where rays goes, it would be refracted not that way, but this way, as I described, because refractive index is negative. So you would refocus it inside of the lens and then focus it again outside of the lens. But even Wisselager himself has not realized that in principle you could do it with arbitrary high precision, so that you would actually completely restore all the phase information here and therefore would be able to image any small fine details of objects under ideal conditions. That was Sir John Pendry, who in his very important breakthrough paper published in 2000, actually claimed that this type of lens has unlimited resolution in principle. Of course, there are always some limitations imposed by the imperfections. And that was a breakthrough result indeed. But unfortunately, well, evil is in details, as we know, and this lens probably never would be possible to realize for the far zone. In other words, to image with resolution beyond the diffraction limit at large distances from the lens. For a simple reason, if something is exponentially increased, and I told you that first this evanescent component exponentially decrease, and then within the lens they exponentially increase, but that all implies that it would be exponentially high sensitivity to any imperfections, which are almost impossible to deal with. So any deviation from the required condition, which could be introduced by roughness or the presence of losses, would kill the device. So it looked like it's not that good way to go, although it's a brilliant idea indeed. And a new idea was proposed, And that was proposed actually by, again, my colleague Evgeny Narimanov and independently by Neide and Geta from University of Pennsylvania. So they suggest it's better not to exponentially re-increase this evanescent component, but rather convert them into propagating components. And just by omitting details, it turns out that these details is by these devices by far more robust. And it has been already demonstrated, actually. This is the idea. So if you have this hyper lens, it's called hyper not because of hypo something, just because the dispersion relation has this hyperbolic functional dependence. Therefore, they called it hyper lens. And that turns out to be very critical, the fact that this dependence is hyperbolic. What really is important about this structure, it consists of, let's say, metallic layers and dielectric layers, which is arranged in the way it's shown here. But what it results in that the effective dielectric permittivity for this direction would be positive, or negative, but for this one would be positive. The fact that it's positive for one direction and negative for another one results in this hyperbolic dispersion. And because of that, it turns out you can convert this evanescent component into propagating one and realize this resolution beyond the diffraction limit far away from your object. And of course, that was immediately, within 4 months, realized experimentally. This experiment was done by Smolyaninov, who is our actually close collaborator on other physics related to optical clocking. He works for British Aeronautics Engineering. And he used this idea, but not for light itself, but rather for these surface plasmon polaritons. And it's much easier to do in this case. But he just basically draw this type of structure, cylindrical structure of metal and dielectric in a plane, and showed this super resolution. And another experiment was done at University of California, Berkeley, by the group led Shang Zheng. He's our friend and collaborator in this field, and obtained a number of breakthrough results. So he literally fabricated this structure, which was quite a challenge. Many layers of this very thin layers of silver and with alumina spaces in between. And he also demonstrated, he imaged this word on with a resolution beyond the diffraction limit. But we keep working, and recently my close associate, Dr. Kildesheim, whom I mentioned already, along with Professor Narimanov, they showed how this hyperlens could be dramatically improved simply by matching the impedance. Electrical engineering background sometimes helps. People in physics don't, well, at least I speak about myself, because my education is in physics, actually. I didn't know much about impedance before I started to work in electrical engineering department. And when you do that, actually, look, you see how more light you get out of your device. But there is still a problem with this device. It's cylindrical in shape. You would have to place object inside, which is not convenient for sensing. And recently, we came with the idea to do it in a planar structure. Basically, this is a result of simulation. It's not a cartoon. So if you in a special required way shape these metallic and dielectric layers, you could make your hyperlens be planar in shape and magnify the image. So let's say you have these 2 points closer than the wavelengths. You wouldn't be able to see it with a microscope, conventional microscope, but because it magnifies, brings it above the diffraction limit, above making the separation larger than the wavelengths, you would be able to see it with conventional microscope. Why it's important? Because you could use it if you realize it, and we work now very hard to fabricate it and to make it reality. You just could use it as standard add-on for conventional microscope. You simply add it to conventional microscopes and you would start seeing things, hopefully, let's say 10 or maybe 100 times smaller than the wavelengths. It would be, of course, a huge breakthrough. If it was light, you would be able to see, let's say, small viruses, DNA, perhaps. That's very promising, although very challenging field as well. Okay, and metamaterials, as exciting as they are, they're enabling also very new physics. And recently, we started to speak of yet another field inspired by these metamaterials, which we call transformation optics. Well, it comes down again to very fundamentals. Perhaps the most important principle which controls the way light propagates in any medium is the Fermat principle. It tells us that the optical path, which is given by the product of refractive index and the geometrical path, should be minimized when light propagates in material. And when the refractive index is constant, that would be, of course, the smallest geometric path would be just a straight line. Therefore, normally in air, glass, water, light propagates along rays, along straight lines. However, with all these ideas, when we can control epsilon mu and could create nearly arbitrary special distribution of these basic parameters, it means that refractive index would be curved in any desired way. But then to satisfy the Fermat principle, light would not go anymore along a straight line. It would have to minimize the optical path, it would actually propagate along very curved geometrical path. So with this idea, we now have a possibility actually to design and engineer space for light, to curve light in any way, so that we could actually create certain areas where light cannot enter at all. And that's the idea of cloaking. Or we could create areas where light sucked in and concentrated to very large magnitudes. And this is the idea behind light concentrator. So if we really started to think of applications, which at least I was not able to think. I thought it wasn't simply possible before. And, well, it's a little bit like really sci-fi, but I mean, it's a type of temptation hard to resist, not to show, because there's so many things back in mythology, back in the history, legends, everywhere in the books, which related to this idea of invisibility. And I guess it's quite excusable if I would show some of them to put in perspective what we are doing. Turns out, well, of course, chameleon, we know this feature, which adjusts its color so that it would match the color of surrounding, therefore it's hard to see. Actually, scientifically, it turns out that the curving of space and time caused by very large gravitational mass in the gravitation theory, mathematically, it just maps the problem we are dealing with light, with these transformation optics. And that's actually a very good thing, because we could mimic many things which occur in the gravitation, which is predicted by the gravitation theory, but things in gravitation almost impossible to observe, because gravitation signal is the smallest signal existing in nature. And we could actually do all that with light. But the point I'd like to make that there is a very close mathematical similarity between what we're doing in transformation optics and what is known for the gravitation theory. For example, as I will show in a moment, we could actually make exactly the same thing as a black hole, but for light. So this is, of course, a famous F-117, which is a stealth fighter. In this case, I hope I would not hurt anybody's feeling. I would not call it really science. It's just wonderful engineering. I mean, it's or whatever, science and engineering probably hard to separate. Because, I mean, what you do here by selecting in the right way shapes, materials, you minimize the signal which goes back to a detector. And of course, that's a beautiful thing, but it's not what I'd like to discuss with you. This is what people call optical camouflage, and this is really simple. It's, if I should say stupid, what you do actually, you just take a camera. With a camera, you take image of that car, which is behind of this person, and then project it onto a close of this person, so which acts like a screen. So that's neither science nor engineering, in my opinion. And actually, but they do some fun of this. Like you see this apparently graduate student working on his PhD, standing in front of a screen, and you have this illusion that you see through this student. Again, I don't see anything particularly complicated about this. When it comes down to cloaking, when we started this effort, I invited my student Vinshan Tsai. He's in Stanford now, a wonderful student. But he would react, his first reaction to many of my suggestions would say, this is ridiculous, professor. That's why I liked him so much. I mean, he would always disagree in the beginning. So, and he actually was the one who first proposed a realistic design for this cloaking in the visible part of the spectrum. And so when I was preparing for some lecture, he actually found these examples. He knows that I like very much examples from literature, history. So, and that's interesting that in two pieces of literature, the idea of cloaking was actually formulated precisely, scientifically precisely, and almost precisely, I should say. That's doesn't happen that often. And one is, of course, a famous piece of literature written in 1897 by Herbert Wells. It's called The Invisible Man, and here's a quotation from there. It was an idea to lower the refractive index of a substance, solid or liquid, to that of air, so far as all practical purposes are concerned. I should correct it slightly. If basically what it says, you need to get of reflectance if you want to clock object. It's only one of the conditions, the easy one. So you need to get rid of reflection. And for that, you need to match refractive index. We already know it's not correct. The reason why I would say this, because to get rid of reflection, you need to match impedance, not refractive index. But for the optical range, since there are, for all conventional material, there are no magnetic response, that it's same thing to match refractive index or impedance. However, when you do have magnetism, it does matter, actually. You need to match impedance. Only small correction. Let's excuse him. It was written in 1897. And another, I don't call it literature, so it's a junk, in my opinion, but with a kind of complimentary title, The Invisible Woman, written by Stan Lee. And here's a quotation from there. She achieves these feats by bending all wavelengths of light in the vicinity around herself without causing any visible distortion. And that's really challenging. So what it says that to make object invisible, light should go around the object like water flows around a stone, get reflected from whatever is in the background and come back to the observer. So you would not see what is going on here. But to make light move like this, that's quite unusual. It's not the way a light propagates and moves in normal materials. And it was Sir John Pendry, who must read both these books, and came up with this idea that if you combine the two, that objects could be invisible in very general terms. Turns out, as I already pointed out, quite before that, and very recently they sent me a paper from Russia. I mean, that's Russians always would do everything early, as they claim. Anyway, so it was 1961, and it's amazing, just formulas one-to-one, which were written by Sir John Pendry, but of course he could not even read that paper because it was not even translated into English. But that's amazing how such wonderful results sometimes come up independently, but with such a big difference in time. And I'm saying all this not to decrease in any way the credit which should be given by Sir John Pendry, because his contribution to this field is simply marvelous. It's unbelievable how many things he did for the field. And, well, that's the idea. Of course, this is stupid. This is just a trick. With camera in my research talks, I never show this, but I thought that it's kind of entertaining. I would show this. So maybe one day, if you would really do this clocking, something like this would be possible. But this is the specific design. This is real calculations, which we did with Winshan Tsai, whom I mentioned, Alex Kildashev and Uday Chitia from my group. And so this is actually results of calculations. And the idea was simple. If you take a cylinder of a glass and place these metallic rods inside of this glass in a way it's shown here, so it looks like basically a round hairbrush. So it turns out that in this case, it's easy to show that effective dielectric permittivity could go from 0 to 1. Because here you have slightly more metal, and metal has negative epsilon, which mixes with positive epsilon of glass, giving the effective epsilon close to 0. But since the metal filling factor decreases toward the outer radius, so that the effective permittivity could go from 0 to 1, which means the refractive index goes from 0 to 1. And it turns out that's actually what is needed for clocking. And this is the results of calculations. When you don't have this required distribution, of course, there is a shadow cast. And when you do this clocking thing, you see light does bend around your clocking device as water around stone, and it doesn't penetrate inside. Recently, we did this work with a BAE system, British Aeronautics Engineering, with Igor Smolyaninov, and it turns out you could do it much easier even, and maybe it becomes a more realistic way, because the clock which I showed actually works only for a single frequency for some fundamental reason. It turns out that by using this tapered waveguide, you could clock in a broad spectral range, which might be an important development. And the thing here is that it's very much in the heart of the transformation optics. Turns out if I take a spherical surface coated with metal and a planar surface coated with metal, then in terms of solution to the Maxwell's equation, it's identical to the situation when you have just a planar slab, but with certain distribution of epsilon and mu. And that distribution turns out to be exactly what is required for clocking, like it's shown here. So you see the dashed line requires describes the perfect clock, and these solid lines describe the distribution of epsilon mu when you transform one situation to another one. And that's actually in the very heart of transformation optics, as I said. And in principle, if you take not spherical surface but slightly different, then you could clock perfectly. So, and in this case, we could speak of very macroscopic objects. It's still tiny, like micron scale, not really, well, let's say 100 micron scale. We're still far from clocking really huge objects. So it's a very simple device, actually. If you have a spherical lens coated with gold, with sitting on top of a planar surface coated with gold as well, then it would work in such a way, according to this idea of transformation optics, that all the central area would be clocked, light would bend around without penetration inside, and that's the idea behind this. I'm afraid I'm running behind my time, but I could very briefly formulate it. Because to have clocking, you see that this ray, which goes to this area where object is hidden, has a larger geometrical path than this one. Therefore, refractive index should be smaller here. Remember that the optical path should be the same. What it turns out, what is required, that the refractive index goes from 1 here to 0 here. That's what is needed for clocking. But in a waveguide, there is always so-called cutoff, when a wave cannot propagate anymore through your waveguide. And that cutoff exactly equivalent to the situation when the refractive index is equal to 0. So when the waveguide becomes small enough so that it's roughly like the wavelengths in size, then wave cannot propagate anymore, and that situation is equivalent to refractive index equals 0. When you move away from there, it's like refractive index goes from 0 to 1. So it's a very simple idea. And moreover, no matter what is the wavelengths, you still would be able to, there still would be a place where this cutoff occurs, and therefore refractive index would be 0 for that particular wavelength. Let's say if wavelength is larger, like red light, the cutoff would occur somewhere here, refractive index is 0 here, and then it increases from 0 to 1. For blue component, it will be somewhere here, and then it increases. But no matter what the wavelengths, the structure itself would actually create this situation when that particular spectral component would be clocked, and light would actually go around the clocked region, which is here. And the clocked region in our experiment was 50 micron. It looks small, but it's actually 100 times larger than the wavelengths. And so what we saw that if you place a particle of the same size as the contact area, 50 micron, then of course the shadow cast. So you see it's very pronounced shadow. However, in the central part where this clocking condition, is fulfilled, light does bend around. And you could see that behind that clocked area, you see light. It means that light, like water, actually flew around this very microscopic range, 100 times larger than the wavelengths, and just keeps going behind that clocked area. There are other approaches to this. I mean, when clocking, ideally you make it so that you don't see the objects, you don't see the clock, you actually see through. That's very challenging to do, although we already have some preliminary demonstrations. You could also do other things like optical mimicry. For example, you have an object, and light incident on the object, it scatters, therefore you see the object. You could create certain distribution of refractive index inside of that object, so it would look like basically there's only flat surface, virtually. And that's relatively easy to do. You just simply punch these holes in a dielectric material, silicon in this case, and when you do it in a certain way so that the refractive index follows the required special distribution, then you could create this situation that actually there is no any scattering. So it looks like there is only flat surface. It's what's called optical mimicry. That has been already realized. All these things are very fresh. It's like a few months old. These things develop here extremely fast. But there are also other very interesting applications related to transformation optics, not only optical clocking. I would say optical clocking is just like the tip of the iceberg. It attracts attention, but many other things could be realized. In this case, you see the results of calculations. It's modeling done by Narimanov and Kildyshev. And it works like optical trap. No matter where light comes from, it would get sucked and comes inside of this object through the right distribution of these parameters epsilon mu. You see how unusual the behavior of light in these transformation optics devices. And actually, I'm wrapping up, so it's my last slide, or one before the last, I'd like to emphasize these metamaterials which enable quite unusual properties such as artificial magnetism, negative refractive index close to zero. We can control light in a way we didn't think in the past. I mean, you really could start being able doing things which are quite unusual, such as this planar hyperlens, which we hope at one day would be just used as a standard add-on tool for microscopes and enable seeing things much smaller than the wavelengths. Or this light concentrator, where you could actually concentrate light in extremely small spot, and that could be used for photovoltaic devices, for example, for efficient conversion of solar energy. Or this optical black hole. All these are not cartoons, but results of simulations. When you really, it does act as a true black hole, but in this case for light. Light actually trapped and concentrated in a certain area. And this is sums up what we accomplished here at Purdue. So we were first to demonstrate negative refractive index for the optical range. Very recently, we're quite proud of this, in collaboration with North Fork State University and Cornell, we demonstrated the world's smallest nanolaser operating in the visible part of the spectrum, which is only 22 nanometers in radius. We also showed the negative refractive index at the shortest wavelength so far, which is the yellow part of the spectrum, and we fabricated these structures which demonstrate artificial magnetism across the entire visible range. But I think the most exciting development of all this and applications for these metamaterials related to this transformation optics, when you really manipulate and control the flow of light and make all these very fantastic devices such as hyperlens, light concentrator, or clocking devices. And the very last but not least thing I'd like to end with is to very sincerely, from the bottom of my heart, to thank the Bjork Nanotechnology Center and all people around me. That's absolutely unique opportunity to work in the place with these cutting-edge facilities and to have this wonderful opportunity to work with great collaborators around me. So I thank you very much for your attention. Right. That's actually a very good question. Since light cannot penetrate in, so if a person is inside of this clock, let's say light source is inside of clock, no light would go out. Energy would be accumulated there infinitely before the material would be broken. So you cannot communicate with outside world if you're inside of a clock unless you choose, instead of sending light, speak. You can still speak. Right. The question was about frequencies, spectral properties of these metamaterials. I should say that since you're dealing here with, as I pointed out, very fundamentals, for example, when you bring refractive index below one, it means that the phase velocity is larger than the speed of light in vacuum. That's quite an unusual situation, but it doesn't contradict causality. It's okay when phase velocity is larger than the speed of light. But the price for that, it could occur only for a single frequency. What is quite typical for metamaterials, the unique properties, such as a negative refractive index, occur in relatively narrow spectral range. But there are ways around, like, for example, this tapered waveguide. It turns out that no matter, I could do it actually for extremely broadband, but in principle, their spectral properties are very interesting. It's not always a disadvantage. Sometimes you could use it as advantage, but their spectral dependence is very strong, unusually strong. You could consider as advantage or as a price you pay for the fact that you bring refractive index into quite unusual domain. For example, domain where it's smaller than one or even negative.
periodic structures.
Right.
Now, I wonder why that is the case, because in the electronic structure, let's say you have a crystal, obviously has a band gap.
Right.
But even if it were an amorphous material like glass,
right.
And still you have a band gap, that's why you can see through glass. But why is it necessary fundamentally that you need periodicity in photonic crystals?
I have a short answer and a long, relatively long answer. A short answer, we don't need it. And that's a big advantage of metamaterials over photonic crystals. All the unusual properties of photonic crystals are based on the fact that there is this Bragg reflection and interference. That's why you have these band gaps, and that's used for guiding all these things. They have to be periodical. And because of that, they're extremely sensitive to all defects. As opposed to photonic crystals, which are built of materials with the size of the structural unit matching the wavelengths, otherwise they wouldn't act as photonic crystals. Metamaterials could be built of elements much smaller than the wavelengths. In fact, I would prefer to have them random, not periodic at all, because periodicity brings some side effects which we are not interested. And as a result of that, metamaterials are by far more robust structures, as in your example with amorphous glass, for example. They are by far more robust structures than photonic crystals. Periodicity is not required for metamaterials as opposed to photonic crystals, because the whole idea of this action, like negative refraction, it has nothing to do with this Bragg reflection and interference. And in this case, I would say it is advantage because it make them more robust structures.
Like to join us, feel free.